Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. A website offers Ohioans all kinds of legal advice, from divorce and other domestic issues to evictions and other issues becoming more prevalent during the pandemic. Details coming up in just a moment. This week, Governor Mike DeWine urged parents to keep their kids up to date on vaccinations. We'll have his comments and those from a doctor in Cincinnati in about 20 minutes. In the second half hour, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, Tracy Townsend talks with Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose about voting in the election. And Kevin Landers profiles the four candidates running for two seats on the Ohio Supreme Court. And I'll wrap up the hour talking with someone from the Bipartisan Policy Center about federal dollars being spent in Ohio to combat the opioid crisis. First up on Columbus Perspective, joining me on the phone, we talked to her a few weeks ago. It is Susan Che, who is the Executive Director of Ohio Legal Help. How are you?
Good, and thank you for having us on again.
Yeah, it was really informative to talk to you a few weeks ago. Tell us about Ohio Legal Help. What is it?
Sure. Well, Ohio Legal Help, we're a statewide website, and we're available 24/7. Folks can come to us, and they're anonymous, and get really good, vetted legal information by legal experts on, you know, really pertinent topics like unemployment and, unfortunately right now, evictions. But we also have information on divorce and dissolution and family law matters as well.
And because of the pandemic and how lives have been disrupted, the sorts of advice that you give has really become timely.
It has. I mean, we also have a COVID-19 hub. We you know, because we are a website, we try to update in real time. So anytime there's an update from, you know, Department of Jobs and Family Services of unemployment, we usually have it up within sometimes that minute, sometimes definitely within 24 hours. You know, and talking about that kind of just in time, what we've noticed since the pandemic is that we've had an almost 400% increase in traffic overnight. So that's folks searching for information generally between like 12 a.m. And 8 a.m. So we really believe in just-in-time information for folks that are relevant.
What are some of the trends, the hot topics that folks are turning to try to figure out how to deal with something?
Unemployment has continued to trend as our number one legal topic area that folks are interested in getting information on and trying to resolve issues, whether, like, for instance, in July when Department of Jobs and Family Services suspended, I think, over 270,000 Ohioans for possible fraud. We had a lot of folks coming to our site searching for answers as to why they had benefits and didn't. So as soon as we heard, we immediately got up information about how they could verify to resolve that situation. So unemployment. But then, you know, we're seeing a lot of folks now coming to our site for eviction because of the CDC eviction moratorium that was declared in September.
Yeah, and the $600 add-on, federal add-on to unemployment benefits has expired, and there's still some supplemental help coming that way, but every little penny makes a difference in times like this for some folks.
Absolutely. So it's interesting when the presidential actions related to unemployment came out, Ohio applied as soon as, and we updated that in real time. So we told folks on both our COVID hub and on our unemployment hub that Ohio had applied, it had been approved, and basically the same night that ODJFS announced that those additional, I think it's $300 this round for the supplemental,
right,
a week, was about to roll out, we had that information up on the website immediately. The first folks to receive it was the folks with the PUA, the pandemic unemployment, and then the traditional unemployment shortly thereafter. So, you know, we had a lot of folks come. I think that gave them some assurance. We are, you know, good, again, good vetted information. So I think folks are coming to our site to get that real-time information. Come to ohiolegalhelp.org. The other thing that was interesting in September is we saw, like, evictions we expected, but we also saw a surge of traffic to our food stamps and our food insecurity page. We've seen steady traffic, but we saw a surge in September as students went back to school and the pandemic EBT card for school-aged children was announced again. And so, again, folks are coming to us as a reliable source of updated information for themselves and their families.
Talking with Susan Che, Executive Director of Ohio Legal Help. And you mentioned it's a statewide website, and it is area-specific.
Yes. Yeah, so, like, I was just, you know, before you know, I got on with you, I actually wanted to kind of see what Franklin County somehow was different from the rest of the state. First of all, Franklin County is one of our number one counties in terms of traffic coming to the site. But what I'm seeing is that Franklin County is trending like the rest of the state. You know, folks in Central Ohio have the same concerns. It's unemployment, I'm looking at it now, COVID-19 kind of eviction protection, SNAP and food assistance. And then after that, they're really looking. It's interesting. We're also seeing an uptick in our we have a stimulus check page that we've had since the beginning of the CARES Act, and we're seeing traffic there again as folks wonder if, you know, Congress is going to enact another stimulus. But again, it's all about economics at this point. Folks are so insecure related to their income.
We've heard news stories about the divorce rate climbing in the pandemic age. Are you seeing anything related to that?
So it's interesting. You know, in March, when I think the pandemic was first kind of, I think, the realization, public awareness, it was our number one. It was still remained as our number one area. Family law has always been our number one area. And then as the pandemic progressed, like April, May, June, July, we saw kind of family law drop out of the top, top areas, if you will. But now we're seeing it again, I think, as folks, you know, everyone says this in a way, but as they adjust to the new normal, maybe as they've sheltered in place with their spouse, we are seeing, again, increased traffic to our divorce and dissolution pages as well. So it has creeped back up into our top three.
That trend matches the kind of talk we're hearing from counselors and therapists and such, too. It was like, you know, you have to kind of pick your battles, so to speak, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was that kind of rallying together. I think we all did it. And then the reality of, you know, the relationship creeps back in as like we said, a new normal kind of emerges.
The rules about evictions, there are protections for renters. Are you seeing any indications of bad landlord behavior?
So we're not. So we have actually a page that's about lockout, and we have not seen an uptick on that page, which is where a landlord takes extrajudicial or basically takes actions outside of the court to evict someone. So we have not seen that. But what we have seen, and we've done a lot of public awareness on it, social media, is folks accessing our information on the CDC eviction moratorium, because tenants have to give their landlords a specific declaration form. And so we have that declaration form on our website. The Supreme Court actually included us in their guidance, and so we've been really trying to get out the word on that. We also have another avenue for tenants to contact us, and we have not seen tenants reaching out to us, because folks can reach out to us via email. And so I'm not saying that it's not an issue, but it's not something that we've picked up either by folks contacting us personally or in our trend data that we're seeing. But we are seeing tenants accessing and taking advantage of the current CDC eviction moratorium. I will say for folks in Franklin County, Impact has indicated that, so that's the Community Action Agency for Rental Assistance, they are maxed out on applications, and so folks should be looking potentially at PRC, which is for the Franklin County Department of Jobs and Family Services, and with, if you're a vet, with Veteran Services for potential rental assistance. It's unclear when Impact will have more dollars again.
Talking with Susan Shea, Executive Director of Ohio Legal Help. So when folks come to the website for legal help, what is it exactly that you're offering them?
Sure. So we offer legal help and information on public benefits like unemployment, but food, SNAP, and Medicaid benefits as well. But we have a lot of information actually on divorce. So that was the number one request when we built the site. So we have a full all the forms that that are approved by the Supreme Court related to obtaining a divorce in the state of Ohio. We also have information on housing, in addition to eviction, basically how to get landlords to make repairs. But we also have information on debt, which we think will be an issue in the future. Debt collection, if you get sued by a debt collector, and bankruptcy as well. And then finally, we also have information on seniors' issues like medical powers of attorneys and healthcare power of attorneys, because especially during COVID, we think folks need to be thinking about those things like living wills, so that if you can't make your own medical decisions, you have a trusted person making those medical decisions for you.
And do you provide names of other agencies or individuals that people can turn to in addition to what you offer?
Absolutely. One of the hallmarks of our site is that we have about 2,000 resources, so those are community resources. And if folks come to the site, we're going to ask you for the county and the city that you live in, because we're going to give you a resource for where you are locally, so not just a long list of resources. So if you picked Columbus and Franklin County, for instance, we would have told you about Impact and also Central Ohio United Way, and basically how to access resources near you. So we have that information, including Columbus Legal Aid, who is obviously here in Columbus. But if you're another part of the state, you just give us your county, and we will tell you your local legal aid and resources as well.
It's great to know, because folks here who have relatives, family members in Chillicothe or Canton or wherever, it works for them equally.
Absolutely. And for evictions, it gets a little tricky. Now, Franklin County, we have one municipal court, but, Cuyahoga has like 12 or 13. So if you tell us the city and the, where you are in Cuyahoga, we'll tell you the right municipal court to get information on your eviction.
Talking with Susan Shea, Executive Director, Ohio Legal Help. Anything else you'd like to add?
Other than, we are open and available 24/7, come to ohiolegalhelp.org and check us out, especially if you're facing eviction. Take action, because there is a moratorium available. It is time limited. It's through the end of the year. Now, it doesn't make your rent go away, but it does give you some time to prepare and maybe also work things out with your landlord. So, again, take action for yourself, and we'll have the lights on for you.
OhioLegalHelp.org. Again, Susan Shea is the executive director. Awfully important information, Susan. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Dave.
Our connections make powerful things happen, uniting individuals and communities. We are Rotary. We are people of action. And together, we turn great ideas into reality by accessing our networks, our experience, and the best of ourselves to make a difference. Around the world, Rotary brings leaders together to build new friendships and to solve problems. Like in Austria, where generations work side by side to build sustainable housing and community centers. In India, volunteers run a mobile blood bank to help provide a steady blood supply for their local community. And in Taiwan, people are working hard to get vulnerable citizens the support and services they need. With over 1 million members, we know what people can do when they come together. Take action with us. Find out more at rotary.org/action.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
I'm a veteran. We hit a mine in Vietnam. When I came home, I didn't know where to turn.
As America's veterans face challenges, DAV is there.
My victory's been never giving up hope. My wife is always there to remind me we have a life to live.
DAV provides a lifetime of support, helping veterans of every generation get the benefits they've earned.
I am a veteran, but after I got out, I spent 2 years alone and homeless.
Every year, DAV helps more than a million veterans so they can reach victories great and small.
My victory was finding the support to get back on my feet. Now I'm getting things right with my family.
I finally admitted, with my PTSD, I wasn't doing well.
But there's more to be done and more victories to be won.
Now I wish I'd found DAV sooner. I am a veteran. My victory is just enjoying each day.
Help support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. This past week, during his regular coronavirus update, Governor Mike DeWine talked about the importance of parents making sure their kids are up to date on vaccinations. He also talked to a doctor in Cincinnati about it. We're presenting that here. It's about 10 minutes. Here's Governor Mike DeWine.
Another difficulty that has arisen during the coronavirus is that patients have not been able to take their children to the pediatrician for well-child visits as often as recommended. This led to a decline in the number of vaccinations administered to protect against diseases such as chickenpox, measles, whooping cough, and polio. We're starting to catch up on these numbers, but there's still some reason to be concerned. There's a danger that these diseases could easily spread if children are not vaccinated. We've seen during this pandemic just how important vaccines can be. While we do not have a vaccine for COVID-19, we can prevent more than a dozen other diseases from harming our children and our communities, and we can do that right now. I want to share this public service announcement, which you will see more in the coming months. It stresses the importance of childhood vaccines in the care of our children.
This boo-boo tells a story. It's a tale of perseverance, ingenuity, and love. This boo-boo is hundreds of years of science and technology. It's protection in the battle against disease and illness. And while we continue to fight COVID-19, childhood vaccinations are more important than ever. This boo-boo, it's love in its purest form.
In addition, in the coming days, the Ohio Department of Medicaid will launch a number of initiatives to encourage childhood immunizations among their members. These efforts will be aimed at increasing safe, convenient access to vaccinations for members by providing mobile vaccination clinics and reducing administrative barriers for providers. It's critical that Ohioans and providers remain vigilant about keeping children up to date on these vaccines. We cannot let COVID-19 prevent us from meeting our essential health care needs. Please contact your pediatrician or your health department today to schedule these important well child visits. Today I've asked Dr. Chris Peltier, a doctor from Cincinnati Children's Medical Center, to join us to tell us more about the importance of childhood vaccines. Doctor is also a provider at Pediatric Associates of Mount Carmel and president-elect of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Governor.
Well, tell us a little bit about in general, what's going on with childhood vaccinations. I know that some doctors have expressed some concerns about, maybe not having enough families come in yet. And maybe tell us a little bit about what you're seeing, but also just tell us the basics. Tell us why is this very important?
Definitely, I'd be glad to. So as a result of the pandemic, as you mentioned, vaccine rates are definitely plummeting, not only here in Ohio, but across the country. We know that during the shutdown last spring, well child visits to pediatricians fell, which ultimately, in addition to many other things like not being able to do vision and hearing screens, ultimately dropped the rates of vaccinations. Many families were obviously worried about going to their pediatrician or their family doctor. Was it safe? And we know, so I want to share with you some data. So from January through April, the CDC reported a cumulative decrease in 2.5 million doses of vaccines that were administered. And just looking at the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the CDC noted a national decrease in over 350,000 visits. There's a national group of independent pediatricians that it really involves about 1,000 pediatricians that share the same electronic health record. And some data from that company showed that decreases in the diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough vaccine dropped almost 50% up through April. And the HPV or human papillomavirus vaccine rates dropped by almost 75%. As you said, it definitely is improving, and we are seeing well visits return to higher levels than they were during the spring. But in many practices, that's still not up to 100% or where it's been. And not only that, but now we're having to try to get in families that delayed their well child visits and their vaccinations when Ohio was shut down.
So why is it important? I mean, I think we all know just intuitively this is important, but What are the consequences if our numbers are not where they need to be and if we don't hit a certain level of children with these vaccinations?
Right, so the ultimate outcome is that we run the risk of an outbreak of vaccine-preventable illnesses like whooping cough, like measles, and a worsening flu epidemic than we normally would have. You may have seen the American Academy of Pediatrics has an infographic that they've been publishing on social media trying to prevent what they call a twindemic. So, very sadly demonstrated where we're at in the fight against COVID. We are at the very beginning of influenza season. And, we worry that if we aren't vaccinating against things like measles, whooping cough, influenza, we're going to see greater closures in schools. We're going to have more impact on the economic outcomes for parents and caregivers. And I think most importantly, there's going to be a strain on the already taxed health system due to COVID to care for these children. There's an interesting study that was published recently in the European journal Lancet that really looked at trying to put in perspective. And what the data that they found showed that for parents that are worried about bringing their children to their pediatrician for risk of getting COVID, for every one death that could be attributed to COVID that could potentially be caught by going to your healthcare provider in delaying vaccinations, 84 deaths in children could be prevented from other vaccine preventable illnesses like whooping cough, measles, and flu. Now, of course, we're not, one death is too many, but it just sort of puts it in perspective when we're saying, if a parent doesn't want to bring their child to the pediatrician for fear they may get exposed to COVID, that one possible prevention of a death could result in 84 other preventable deaths due to other illnesses. Failure to vaccinate against these diseases leaves our Ohio children unnecessarily vulnerable. And with COVID-19 transmissions running high, as you so eloquently stated at the beginning of this press conference, it's more important to vaccinate kids against all preventable vaccine illnesses, but also influenza. And the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that everybody age 6 months and up should be vaccinated against influenza, ideally by Halloween. We have the Ohio AAP has a social media campaign right now, no boo without flu. So trying to get your flu vaccine by Halloween.
And the whooping cough is not something that we think exists anymore, but it does, right? We've had occasionally there's an outbreak that you'll see somewhere in the country, sometimes maybe even Ohio, I think. So
we see outbreaks every year. It's probably the most common vaccine preventable illness that we see every year. We have outbreaks in our local schools.
And the significance of whooping cough is what? Tell us about it.
So, it in older children, it can cause what's known as the 100-day cough. So kids can have sort of this nagging cough. They may feel sick. The biggest thing is they're contagious, so they have to be isolated during their contagious period. The real risk is in young infants and babies, and that whooping cough can cause young infants to stop breathing. And ultimately, we see deaths every year from whooping cough in young infants.
Wow. And pretty much preventable, right?
Exactly.
Doctor, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Last question. If anybody's watching this and they have a child Who can they contact if they don't have a doctor? What do they do?
Well, so before I answer that question, I will say for those families that do have a pediatrician, ask your pediatrician. You know, make sure you're up to date. When you don't just save vaccines for well visits. If you're coming in for an ill visit, ask your pediatrician. Am I up to date on my vaccines? Can I get a flu shot today? Pediatricians' offices are safe. They're open. We have flu vaccine and we have all of the other vaccines that children need. If you don't have a primary care provider, I would recommend families go to their local health department. They can go to the health department and get vaccines. Vaccines at both your pediatricians as well as your local health department are completely free of charge. And Ohio has a vaccine registry program that my office participates in, all of the county health departments participate in. And even if you don't have a copy of your child's shot record and you don't know which vaccines your child may be due for, your pediatrician or the county health department can go into that IMPACT vaccine registry and see what vaccines your child is due for.
Doctor, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
That's again Governor Mike DeWine from his coronavirus update this past week, talking with Dr. Chris Peltier, a pediatrics specialist in Cincinnati.
You've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. You have to carefully monitor your health for the rest of your life. And you have an increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease.
Cut. Take two. Action.
You've been diagnosed with a new purpose, to fight for the amazing life you've made for yourself. To look that risk of heart disease square in the face and say, no, not me. You've been given a new opportunity to live. Get started at nodiabetesbyheart.org.
There's a place to share the joy of your team winning it all, and a place to share a laugh about skiing and taking a fall. There's a place to share photos of pets or singing in the choir or the time you ate a pepper and your mouth was on fire. But we could all be better at sharing how we're feeling inside. 76% of employees have struggled with at least one issue that affected their mental health. When you share, you're not alone. Ask about your company's emotional health benefits. Visit heart.org/sharing. Brought to you by the American Heart Association.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Tracy Townsend from her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. Here's Tracy.
A significant number of Franklin County voters got the wrong absentee ballot in their mailbox. Officials say somehow a piece of computer equipment was disabled and caused that problem. It caused a lot of confusion and created questions. 10 TV's Kevin Landers took those top questions about the mix-up to the people in charge.
With only 26 days before Election Day, Franklin County voters are wondering if the ballot they received is the right one, and if they did fill out the wrong ballot and turn it in, what now?
Let me assure you, no vote will be counted twice, and every voter will receive an accurate ballot. And that ballot will be counted.
10 TV viewers have a lot of questions about their ballots, and we took those questions to the Board of Elections. Question one, how long should one wait on a correct ballot before taking additional action?
We anticipate new ballots being produced and issued within 72 hours.
That's after the Board of Elections determines how many ballots were sent in error. If you don't want to wait, you can go vote in person at the Franklin County Board of Elections. Question two, what if I already mailed back or dropped off the wrong ballot? The Board of Elections asks that you call its consumer hotline at 614-525-3100. A volunteer can immediately check to see if you received the wrong ballot. If you did fill out the wrong ballot, you can vote in person or have a new ballot mailed to you. Question three, I received a text from Common Cause Ohio asking me to confirm my ballot. Is this legit?
That's the first that I'm aware of it, and so I really can't speak to Common Cause sending text messages.
Common Cause of Ohio said phone numbers of those who request absentee ballots are public record, and while they didn't get permission from the Board of Elections to send out the text alert, a spokesperson said the intent was to stop as many incorrect ballots as possible from being turned in. Kevin Landers, 10 TV News.
And because of the pandemic, many people aren't waiting until Election Day to vote. Instead, they're voting early in person. 10 TV's Stephanie Stanovich talked with some of the first voters to do so.
The line is what many people noticed right away pulling into the parking lot.
It was scary. It was wrapped around the building, behind the building. But it picked up pretty quick. So
actually, it went pretty good, pretty fast.
However, it didn't discourage these early voters from being here.
I still say, still come out to vote, no matter how long it takes.
One 22-year-old got here around 6 a.m.
You know, I've been waiting for this for 4 years.
Max Littman says there's just something about in-person voting.
There's something powerful, you know, about pushing the button and just seeing it in front of you that you can't do when you just mark your ballot. I voted by mail in 2018 and it wasn't the same.
Early voting for some was more convenient.
I work a different shift and I was off and I was able to get out here.
And many have their own opinions on why voting in general is so important.
It's very important because my feelings, Dr. King, because he fights so hard for us to keep on voting. So I hope people keep still doing that.
If you want change, get out here and vote.
Change social injustice and you know, without a voice and without a vote, we can't make changes.
Voting is very important, you know, from all ages. The problem with what we had this year, that's why it's more important to vote.
Thank you.
And this voter says, of course, everyone has their own viewpoints.
When you stand in a line, nobody cares about that. They care about their vote.
And again, that was Stephanie Stanovich reporting. Now, whether you vote absentee, by mail, or vote early in person, you probably have some questions. There is no one better to answer those questions than Frank LaRose. It's his job to make sure your vote gets counted on Election Day. He talked with 10TV's Bennett Haberly this week, and they started with the question of, how can I vote absentee?
Ohioans know that the best way to return your absentee ballot, and this has been the case for a long time, is to simply mail it back in. That's a trustworthy way to return your ballot. And by the way, that's the way that vast majority of Ohioans are going to return their absentee ballots. And then you can go and track it at voteohio.gov. That's the way to make sure and be confident that your ballot was received by your Board of Elections. Now, the law also allows two other ways. You can personally deliver your ballot to the director of the Board of Elections, or you can have a family member personally deliver your ballot to the Board of Elections. And we've made that more convenient than ever by directing every county Board of Elections to have a secure receptacle available 24 hours a day. That's never been the case before in Ohio in the past for a general election, and now that is. In fact, many counties are going to set up drive-through, drop-off opportunities in the days leading up to the election.
As we begin early voting, obviously there is a lot of people who are wanting to take part in that. We've seen that at the Board of Elections, the line wrapping around the building. People may be wondering, is it safe for me to vote under these conditions? You know, we've never done this, you know, against this backdrop in modern times of having an election against the backdrop of a pandemic. So I know there are a lot of people out there who are wondering, is it safe for me to show up?
You know, it absolutely is. And this is something that we've been working on really since the pandemic began in March, working with our partners at the CDC and the Ohio Department of Health, as well as our local health departments and our county boards of elections. As a result of those conversations and the work that we've done throughout the spring and throughout the summer, months ago, we issued a health guidance document for all the boards of elections to follow. Maybe this is my military background, but I'm a big fan of checklists. So we laid out a 61-point checklist. If the boards of elections follow this, and to be clear, they're required to follow this checklist, then they will create a safe and healthy environment for both early in-person voting and election day voting. Boards of elections are following that. It means things like really what you're accustomed to seeing at your favorite grocery store or at your favorite pharmacy, for example. It's safe social distancing. It's setting up the voting machines at least 6 feet apart. It's making sure that if there is a line that people are standing 6 feet apart, and where possible, having a door in separate from a door out, using a doorstop to hold the door open so people aren't touching it all day, where that makes sense. Of course, wiping down the voting machines and any other kind of frequently touched surface. It also means that the boards of elections have been supplied with massive quantities of personal protective equipment. If you feel safe going to the grocery store, you should absolutely feel safe coming and voting in person in Ohio. And that's our guarantee. That's what we're working to do to make sure that everybody can feel safe to come and vote.
What about the use of the Postal Service? Is there any concern for people who are using this absentee ballot system that their mail, their ballot may not get there in time?
The Postal Service has been very loud and clear in their communication with us as the nation's elections officials that for them, elections mail is their top priority. Now, it's up to us to hold them to account on that and make sure that they deliver on that commitment. But here are the things that they've committed to doing. They've said that they're going to institute what's called an all-clear procedure in all of their sorting facilities. What that means is that official elections mail logo, I think we're all used to seeing it on the ballot envelopes. It's got that swoosh with the stars on it. It says official elections mail. Anything with that logo on it, the Postal Service is going to make sure is cleared out of the building every day. Nothing gets left behind or stuck in a sorting machine or put aside in a bin. That all-clear procedure is really important. They also committed to keeping Ohio mail sorted in Ohio. In some cases, they've been shipping mail out of state to other sorting facilities. That may have been an efficiency improvement for the Postal Service, but it also cost time. They also committed to establishing personal relationships at the local level between your local postmaster and your local elections officials. They're exchanging cell phone numbers so they know how to get a hold of each other on the weekends, for example. Those are the kind of thing that the U.S. Postal Service is committed to, in addition to handling all election mail as first-class mail, no matter what postage is on it. No elections mail will get returned for lack of postage.
We did have a couple other viewer questions, particularly from some people who have college students in their families who may be off to college this fall and are maybe concerned about their absentee ballot arriving on time or sending it back in, and are wondering whether or not they can still vote in person. So maybe that's a good question to come up is, if I've already requested my absentee ballot, is it possible I can still vote in person?
Here's the deal. If you request an absentee ballot and then decide for whatever reason that you actually want to go vote in person, the best thing to do is take that absentee ballot and go down to your early voting center. They'll invalidate it and they'll let you vote there in person at the early voting center. Of course, if you show up on election day and want to vote after having already requested an absentee ballot, at that point, they'll have to give you a provisional ballot. Now, simply what that means is that's that mechanism for capturing your intent. We want to let you vote, but then we need to put that aside because the Board of Elections needs to verify that you didn't also return your absentee ballot. They've got to check because we believe everybody deserves a vote, but just one.
Okay, what other questions do you have? We've made it very easy for you to ask. Just send us a text, 614-460-3345. Text us your question. Our voter access team will work to get you some answers. We're working both in front of and behind the camera. We're looking into issues, we're looking into candidates, as well as investigating disinformation about this year's election. We are also putting together a team of political experts to bring you live analysis on election night. The vice presidential debate. Of course, the coronavirus and President Trump's diagnosis were up for debate.
Well, the American people have witnessed what is the greatest failure of any presidential administration in the history of our country. And here are the facts. 210,000 dead people in our country in just the last several months. Over 7 million people who have contracted this disease. One in five businesses closed. We're looking at frontline workers who have been treated like sacrificial workers. We are looking at over 30 million people who in the last several months had to file for unemployment. And here's the thing. On January 28th, the vice president and the president were informed about the nature of this pandemic. They were informed that it's lethal in consequence, that it is airborne, that it will affect young people, and that it would be contracted because it is airborne. And they knew what was happening, and they didn't tell you.
Our nation has gone through a very challenging time this year. But I want the American people to know that from the very first day, President Donald Trump has put the health of America first. Before, there were more than five cases in the United States, all people who had returned from China. President Donald Trump did what no other American president had ever done, and that was he suspended all travel from China, the second largest economy in the world. Now, Senator Joe Biden opposed that decision. He said it was xenophobic and hysterical. But I can tell you, having led the White House Coronavirus Task Force, that that decision alone by President Trump bought us invaluable time to stand up the greatest national mobilization since World War II. And I believe it saved hundreds of thousands of American lives.
The vice presidential debate was quite different than that debate we watched in Cleveland between the presidential candidates. It played out in Salt Lake City at the University of Utah. Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris were seated. They were 12 feet apart, and they were buffered, so to speak, by that plexiglass. The debate was moderated by Susan Page from USA Today. Now, on the day after, a CNN instant poll of registered voters who watched showed 6 in 10, or 59%, said Harris won. 38% said Vice President Mike Pence won the debate. I talk with party reps right here in our state on Thursday, and as you might expect, each calls their candidate the winner.
Vice President Pence won the debate. He won on taxes. He won on energy policy. He won on China. He won on foreign policy. Vice President Pence knocked it out of the park. He was well prepared. He laid out how the Trump-Pence administration has been quite successful the last 3.5 years. And he pointed out Kamala Harris's flip-flops and the things that she said, you know, she and Joe Biden have clearly said they're going to ban fracking, and Kamala Harris said the opposite in her debate, and it's on record. They've said that they are going to raise taxes on day one. She tried to say the opposite. So the American people know what the Biden campaign has said, what their policies are, whether it's the Green New Deal or banning fracking, and Vice President Pence clearly called them out on it, on the hypocrisy.
I think she hit a home run, because these vice presidential debates are about showing that you're ready for leadership. That's the role of the vice president, advising the president, and then in the event of a tragedy or uncertainty, being able to step in the shoes of the president. And I think what you saw last night with Senator Harris is someone who has experience, her time as a senator, her time as the attorney general of California, which is the largest justice department outside of the United States Justice Department, and even her time in local government in San Francisco. At all levels of government, she has the experience. She also has the knowledge and the capability to lead, and we saw that last night too, especially when you compare and contrast that with the ineptitude and the failures of the Trump administration. Whether it's the coronavirus and 200,000 people dead, 30 million Americans unemployed, 7 million Americans infected, 20%, 1 in 5 businesses, small businesses are closing their doors, or the desire to get rid of the Affordable Care Act with no plan to replace it.
One of the biggest arguments in that vice presidential debate was whether Joe Biden would raise taxes on all Americans. We've had our Verify team breaking down the facts. Here's Jason Puckett.
Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence argued over Joe Biden's plan for taxes. Here's a clip.
Joe Biden has been very clear. He will not raise taxes on anybody who makes less than $400,000 a year.
He said he's going to repeal the Trump tax cuts.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
It would be important if you said the truth. Joe Biden said twice in the debate last week that he's going to repeal the Trump tax cuts.
Okay, two opposite arguments. Pence claims Biden will raise taxes on almost all Americans by repealing existing tax cuts. But Harris claims Biden's tax plan will only raise taxes on people making $400,000 a year or more. To break down these arguments, we looked at Biden's published tax plans and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that became law in 2017, as well as tax analyses by four different bipartisan think tanks and policy organizations. So let's run this line by line.
Joe Biden has been very clear. He will not raise taxes on anybody who makes less than $400,000 a year.
This is true. Biden has consistently said he will not raise taxes on anyone making under $400,000 a year. And that statement is clearly laid out in his tax plans on his website. All four analyses agreed that Biden's plans wouldn't add any direct taxes on people making less than $400,000. Back to the clip.
Joe Biden said twice in the debate last week that he's going to repeal the Trump tax cuts.
This is true, but needs context. Biden has said he will repeal parts of Trump's 2018 tax cuts, but not all of them. Analyses by the Tax Policy Center and Tax Foundation showed that Biden would only repeal tax cuts for people with incomes above that $400,000 mark. And it's worth noting, Biden can't actually repeal any of those taxes on his own. The tax cuts in 2018 were signed into law, meaning Biden would need another act of Congress to change them. Bottom line, Biden's tax plan, as currently written, does not call for the direct increase of taxes on anyone making less than $400,000 a year in income. And Biden is only calling for the repeal of tax cuts on people above that income line. Folks, if you have other claims or questions you want us to look into, send us an email. With your Verify, I'm Jason Puckett.
The coronavirus cases are going up in the Buckeye State. What the governor has to say about this very orange risk map
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Before I was adopted, I felt like nobody wanted me. I felt like my life was already over.
At a certain age, they don't want you. You're troubled and stuff.
Even if I wanted to be adopted, who would adopt a 17-year-old?
Inside, I knew, like, I'm not a troubled kid. I know what I'm in for, why I'm here.
My biggest fear was that I would age out and not know how to be sufficient on my own.
I had nightmares every single day at my birth mom's house. It was just really scary for me living there.
I was scared, I was lost, and I felt hopeless.
I felt like, don't I deserve to feel happy and loved?
I just wish I'd gotten adopted sooner.
Unfortunately, the number of children waiting to be adopted from foster care is on the rise. The Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption is the only public nonprofit charity in the U.S. focused exclusively on foster care adoption. You can help. Go to DaveThomasFoundation.org to learn more.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Back to Tracy Townsend, courtesy of 10TV.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says there are things we can all learn from the president's COVID-19 diagnosis.
I wish the president would wear the mask more. I wish he'd wear it all the time when he was in public. And I said that before, you know, he had the coronavirus.
And the state of Ohio's new county risk level map is out. There are several central Ohio counties now in the red. That's really the highest number since July. Remember, red is level 3.
The virus is spreading in more areas of the state and impacting a wider swath of Ohio. Again, as we talk to public health departments, what they tell us when they try to drill down on the causes of this spread lacks social distancing, not enough people wearing masks, not enough people following quarantine and isolation guidance.
One of the most important elections in Ohio this year is also one of the least discussed. Two seats on the Ohio Supreme Court are up for grabs, and the outcome could change the shape of the court for the next 6 years. Kevin Landers explains what you need to know about the candidates.
The men and women who sit on the Ohio Supreme Court make decisions that touch the lives of every Ohioan. Issues like school funding, legislative and congressional districts, and the death penalty. Now let's meet the candidates running for the Ohio Supreme Court.
58-year-old Supreme Court Justice Judith French, a Republican, is the incumbent, taking on 63-year-old Democrat Jennifer Bruner, a former Secretary of State and currently serving on the 10th District Court of Appeals. French calls herself a judicial conservative and promises to apply the law and won't legislate from the bench. She argued the landmark 2002 U.S. Supreme Court case that upheld the constitutionality of using tax dollars to send students to private and religious schools. Judge Bruner paints herself as someone who has never been appointed as a judge, unlike her opponent, saying she's had to win every election. She credits her expertise in election law and international law as traits that separate her from her opponent. Both Bruner and French see sentencing reform as critical for racial justice in Ohio. While both served on the 10th District Court of Appeals, French credits her ability to write decisions within a 90-day guideline in all but 5 times, while Bruner, she says, has missed that deadline 363 times over the past 4 years. The other open seat pits 58-year-old Ohio Supreme Court Justice Sharon Kennedy, a Republican, against 56-year-old Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Judge John P. O'Donnell, a Democrat. O'Donnell is perhaps the most controversial of the candidates running. In a 2015 bench trial ruling, he acquitted Cleveland police officer Michael Brillo in the 2012 shooting deaths of black motorist Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams. This will be his third time running for a seat on the Supreme Court. His challenger, Justice Kennedy, was a police officer before turning to the law. She believes judges should, quote, interpret the law, not rewrite it from the bench. Kennedy wrote a dissenting opinion in May 2020 in a case involving the constitutionality of a 2015 law that allowed the state of Ohio to take over academically struggling Youngstown City schools. Kennedy believed the section of the Constitution leaves it up to the legislature, not the courts, to decide the rules. Her opponent disagreed, saying it amounts to let's just trust legislators to uphold their oath of office. O'Donnell also criticized Kennedy's position on two cases in which she would have allowed utilities to keep $500 million in fees that were ruled improper. Both Kennedy and O'Donnell acknowledge the need to address racial inequalities and unfair sentences. Three of the candidates, Kennedy, French, and O'Donnell, have declined to step aside on cases before the court where a party has donated more than $1,000 to their campaign in the prior 12 months. Bruner has sidestepped the question, saying, quote, judges are not supposed to make promises about their judicial conduct.
Since 1986, those who've controlled the gavel at the Ohio Supreme Court have been Republican. But this November, it could switch from 5-2 Republican to 4-3 Democrat on November 3rd. Reporting from downtown, Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
All four candidates took part in a virtual forum. 10TV is going to post the event on our website. We do thank you for joining us today. It was great to have you here. Remember, if it affects you, your family, and Ohio, we're here to make sure those accountable face the state.
That's again Tracy Townsend from our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
When I grow up, I want to be a doctor, because that's a really important job. I would help kids get better and make everything super fun. I'd have a cool waiting room with games, toys, and a huge TV.
If your child is sick over and over again, it could be PI, a serious defect of the immune system. Early testing gives children a chance to dream.
And I'll give every kid a cherry lollipop, because that's the best flavor.
Jeffrey Modell Foundation, helping children reach for their dreams. Visit info4pi.org.
In times of fear, World Vision has been there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've stood with kids and families during some of the world's hardest times. Through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and support, helping rebuild lives, and empowering entire communities to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're doing the same today. Because rising to these challenges is in our DNA. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, at home and abroad, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
Your voice, your vote. In our democracy, they matter and make our community and our country stronger. So make yours count. Get registered. Learn the issues. Know the candidates. And vote fire on November 3rd. Visit vote411.org for registration and election information. This message is furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me on the phone is Dr. Anand Parekh, who is the Chief Medical Advisor for the Bipartisan Policy Center. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for talking to us. Tell us briefly what the Bipartisan Policy Center is.
Sure. So we're a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., that tries to take the best ideas from both political parties to promote health and security, as well as opportunity. We were founded 13 years ago by four former Senate majority leaders.
And you've been looking at the opioid crisis, which kills drug overdoses, kills 70,000 people a year nationwide, including more than 4,000 in Ohio. And this recent study specifically involved Ohio with a few other states.
That's absolutely right. You know, Dave, we're in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic, but it's important to remember that we're all also in the midst of an opioid use disorder epidemic. Of that 70,000 that you quoted, 50,000 roughly continue to die from opioid use disorder. So we wanted to really ask the question, how is the federal government supporting states like Ohio? And so what we released, what we are releasing today is a comprehensive, transparent analysis of federal funding. We found $7.6 billion, 60 separate funding streams going to states across the country. In Ohio, it's about $271 million in fiscal year 2019. Now, most of the funding goes to prevention and treatment and recovery. There's a small share that goes to research and law enforcement and interdiction. We are also seeing increasing overdose deaths due to polysubstance use, so that's concerning, as well as rising rates of overdose deaths in communities of color. So lots of findings here. I think that the main point is we need constant vigilance because this is a public health challenge that is still with us.
You mentioned $271 million in funding from the federal government to combat this. 2 years ago, it was $119 million, so a dramatic improvement, and yet the death rate stays high. Is it effective?
Well, that's a really important question. One of the recommendations here is we need more transparent of evaluations of each of the 60 funding streams to understand what is effective, what is not, what are the evidence-based interventions or not being implemented. So I think the effectiveness piece is critical. In Ohio, we did see significant reductions in death rates, as you'll recall, from 2017 to 2018. Unfortunately, provisional data looks like in 2018 to 2019, there was a bump up, and then we're all concerned that COVID-19 is exacerbating the situation by limiting access to harm reduction and treatment. So, this is still a very important point at the epidemic, and I think the key message is the federal support to Ohio is necessary, but it's not sufficient.
One of the things that you cite is a need for better treatment of inmates as they transition back into society. And Ohio has 50,000 state prison inmates. And I think a lot of people think those are long-term prisoners, but there's a huge turnover rate in prisons. And a lot of them are probably there in one way or another because of drugs.
Now, that's such an important point because many times the incarcerated population, particularly those who have opioid use disorder, are not getting access to the treatment they need. And then upon reentry, Dave, which is a highly, highly critical point where rates of overdose increase, there's often not a smooth transition. So oftentimes individuals don't have insurance, they don't have access to treatment, they don't have access to recovery services, supported services like housing. So it's really important, and Ohio is doing some work in this area, but at-risk populations, such as incarcerated populations and upon reentry, there needs to continue to be much more attention needed there, as well as, I would say more broadly, criminal justice reform and prevention to divert individuals who don't need to be incarcerated but need treatment. Again, this is first and foremost a public health challenge, and we need to treat it like that.
Talking with Dr. Anand Parekh, he's chief medical advisor for the Bipartisan Policy Center. What are some main points that you want to get out about this study?
Well, there's three main points from the Bipartisan Policy Center's standpoint in terms of how the federal government can be a better partner to Ohio. One is what we're hearing from Ohio state leaders as well as others. There needs to be sustainable funding. Right now, the need is outstripping the supply, just looking at the fact that a minority of individuals with opioid use disorder are really accessing the gold standard medication-assisted treatment to treat opioid use disorder. We need to better evaluate current funding. We need to also hone in on communities of color. We're seeing a really fast and increasing rates of overdose in communities of color, so we need to focus on cultural competency trainings and interventions to ensure individuals get into treatment and are retained. I think the second key point, Dave, is we need to continue to focus, as I mentioned, on at-risk populations, whether that's polysubstance users, whether that's injection drug users, and ensuring that harm reduction programs, there are so many in Ohio syringe exchange programs, are up and running, and those are important. They're evidence-based. They don't increase drug use, but they facilitate treatment. We need to focus on criminal justice. So that's really the second take-home. And then the third is, there are often an array of federal rules and regulations that get in the way of Ohio and various states to increase access to treatment. So, for example, during COVID-19, we've seen the benefit of allowing for buprenorphine initiation through telemedicine. We're seeing benefits of allowing take-home methadone from opioid treatment facilities. All of this really expands treatment. And also the Medicaid program. Ohio is a state that's expanded Medicaid. That's important. 4 in 10 individuals with opioid use disorder are Medicaid beneficiaries. We need to make sure there are no barriers in the Medicaid program, like prior authorization, that serves as a barrier to ensure people get treatment. So I think there are a lot of things here that states can take away. There are things here that the federal government needs to do to be a better partner to states like Ohio.
Dr. Parekh, if folks want to see this study online, can they find it?
Yes, please visit bipartisanpolicy. That's all one word, .org, bipartisanpolicy.org. The report is released today, and so we value your review and hope it's informative and helpful.
Dr. Anand Parekh, Chief Medical Advisor, Bipartisan Policy Center. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Dave.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM. Sports Radio, 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.